This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
And that is hammered! Oh my!
Man, that ball got out of here in a hurry. You know, anything travels that far ought to have a damn stewardess on it, don't you think?
High drive! Left field!
This is a simple game. You throw the ball, you hit the ball, you catch the ball. You got it?
You're listening to The Roundtable with Grant Brisby, Andy McCullough, and Mark Carrig on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 37 of The Roundtable. I am Grant Brisby. I'm here with Andy McCullough and Mark Carrig. Gentlemen, let's just get right into it. Carlos Correa with the Brewers. The fit to me is tremendous. What are you guys thinking about Correa on the Brewers?
You knew when they moved Colton Wong and Hunter Renfroe, they were clearing a spot, right? And, you know, there was obviously the physical drama. There are no doctors in the state of Wisconsin. They were recently, you know, sort of outlawed. And so it makes a lot of sense, you know. 1 year, $75 million, you know, get the most out of what you got from Woodruff and Burns. It's going to be fun. You know, really excited. Brew Crew's back.
They really thread the needle on this. You know, they thread $75 million in 1 year through the needle. I love it. Aggressive move.
Do you feel like you have anything more to say, and I'm talking about ever, about Carlos Correa? Like, is he banned from our podcast? Like,
yeah, it's not his fault.
No, but like, we don't never need to mention him again. Like, I feel like...
This poor guy, you think he told the plate to move? This poor guy? Like, Carlos Correa, I will continue saying, Carlos Correa is like a top 10 player in baseball. He's awesome. Like, he's so good at baseball. And so if you're the Twins, I was talking about this with someone recently, right? Because someone asked me basically like, okay, why? Okay, so we understand why the Mets, the 12-year deal fell apart, right? Why didn't the Mets do the 6-year deal? Like, you're still – and the way the person explained to me, and it made a lot of sense, is that the Mets can go get Manny Machado next year. They can go get Shohei Ohtani next year. They can, you know, do whatever they want financially. If you're the Minnesota Twins, this is like your one chance – to get a 5-7 win player on like a below market deal. Like, you have to do it. Like, you have to do this, essentially. And so 6 for $200, while it was apparently like $50 million more than what the Mets asked, and, you know, $125 million more than the Brewers 1 year offer, you kind of have to do it if you're the Twins, because this is like the only way to have access to that type of player. It's the same reason why they had to sign Byron Buxton, even though Buxton's going to play 90 games every season. You know, you just have to have you can't let that player go, because in terms of the free agent market, they will never have access to that level of talent.
The other part of this too is that they have the player already for the last year, so no one's going to know him on that market better than the Minnesota Twins. Certainly the Mets had the question marks, the Giants have the question marks. Well, they didn't have the player. Whereas at least Minnesota's dealt with him for a year. I think, you know, and to Andy's point, yeah, like, the, you know, credit to those guys like Falvey and all of them, because, you know, Thad Levine, they understood, as Andy said, this is your one shot to get somebody at that level. You can't miss. So I think a combination of recognizing the urgency of the situation, but also, hey, they had a year head start. They've had a chance to evaluate this guy on multiple levels, not just physically, but also how he fits, what he does for them off the field. You know, they're not having to take somebody's word for that. They've lived through it. So I think that was a smart thing to do. If you're going to take a risk, do it with someone that you've got some kind of history with already.
Gentlemen, these are measured takes. I prefer my Correa takes to have histrionics behind them. I prefer, it's like I've been served a bowl of delicious jambalaya, but there's no spice. No one's yelling at each other. This is all very reasonable, and I agree with all of it, and I hate it. Like, come on, isn't someone like at fault? Isn't someone bad? Boris, can't we say he's evil, or is it, or the owners? I can't keep track. Someone's bad. It's Farhan. They're back.
It's far. Yeah, Farhan owes me a phone call. So for now, let's play again.
God, what year is this? How many? What's the backlog now on that?
Well, yeah. Gosh, unread text messages over and over and over. Anyway, you know, I thought Ken Rosenthal, our esteemed colleague, wrote a very interesting and sort of nuanced sort of piece examining Scott Boras's role in it and basically posing the question, right? Like, did Boras, like, you know, as we like to say on the show, did he biff it, right? Like, did he misread the market? And it's kind of like, you know, and what Ken came to the conclusion based on reporting and, you know, similar to the conversations I've had with people, you know, because I'm also a journalist who talks to people. Not really. Like, the guy flunked a physical twice. What are you supposed to do? Like, you don't, like, come into the you know, the negotiating table and you're like, hey, just so you know, there might be a chance that his ankle has a real problem. You know, like, you gotta, you know, he still got him $200 million, so that could go to 275. Not bad.
I thought his pivot, his immediate pivot to the Mets, was brilliant, because what he was trying to do, and I'm just a novice on the outside, but I thought he was trying to do something like get Steve Cohen to make dumb comments to the press and give Boras back some of the leverage that he lost when the Giants pulled out. And I think that happened. The Mets just, Cohen just maybe checked himself at the right time for the Mets to get into that $300 million deal. But I thought that initial play was brilliant. And then once that fell through, he's a little bit, okay, there's not as much leverage, but he still did well. Yeah.
You don't have the Dodgers, right? You don't have the Yankees. The Red Sox are doing interesting things. I had no idea Trevor Story was hurt, apparently.
I bet you the Giants would have loved that deal of the Twins, but they went out and they signed Conforto, and they spent that money, Rogers and stuff.
You can't spend both of that. You can't have Conforto and Correa. No budget can. Are you kidding me? Is that a serious thing they're trying to argue?
No. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying, like, yeah. We took a shot in there.
They seem sort of exhausted by, and their medical people, like, didn't feel comfortable in their assessment. You know, that's the weird thing about this is, like, it's not a current injury based on what everyone is saying. It's the belief that at some point this will get bad, right? That's kind of new territory, because, you know, like, if you're a pitcher, maybe we've talked about this before, but if you're a pitcher, right, and you've got an elbow, right, issue, right, and you flunk your physical, you'd be like, okay, look, he's got a partially torn, what's it called? What's the ligament called?
Ulnar collateral ligament.
UCL. Sorry, I went through ACL, MCL, and PCL. I've been rereading Friday Night Lights
with arm meniscus. Miles'
knee. So you got you got a partially torn UCL. Okay, so what happens if you tear the UCL? You get Tommy John surgery. Well, you know what the rehab is for this. Ankle's not really a thing. It's not really like, there's not like, oh, well, if you have a, you know, an ankle, Tommy John, it takes this amount of time. So it's just harder to, you know, it's unclear what his mobility will be if he gets hurt, you know, whatever. It's weird territory.
It's not even a thing that gets talked about unless he gets smoked in that ankle and it feels like a piano tuning fork.
Right.
Like, I mean, that's the only reason that this thing even got resurfaced. Now, of course, it's in every report and all that, but what gave it new life was, if I recall correctly, he got plunked or something.
No, he slid hard into second base.
That's what it is. And then felt it and described the plate in his ankle. And so it almost revived this thing that happened so long ago. And then it's really, it was a vivid description, to his credit. Like, we talked about the vibration in there, like, and every time I read it, like, my ankle hurt. Like, so I don't know. It's just amazing to me that, you know, without that freak incident, I don't know if this is the conversation, you know, I mean, hey, for all I know it is, right? Like, it's still in the report and all that stuff, but I feel like it gained a little bit of traction just because of that incident during the season.
My chronology of it is that the Giants had concerns, and our own fantastic Dan Hayes said, wait a second, I included a quote from this in one of my September pieces. And then he was like messaging it to me like, this is not nothing. And so it happened to back up that the Giants weren't just being ninnies. I think, to Andy's point, like, if you want to make this analogous to a pitcher with Tommy John surgery, this would be like his ligament is replaced from a cadaver, but the ligament's haunted, right? Like the cadaver did bad things in its life, and now you have a haunted ligament in the ankle, so to speak, metaphorically.
I like that. I like that. Yeah, that's a good that's a good analogy.
What about Devers with the Red Sox? Any juice with that, or they had to do it, and that's that story?
No, they didn't.
Are you not pro labor?
That's a good point. We may get to that later. We may get to that later when we talk about owners misspeaking. Good for Rafael Devers. That deal is bonkers. But whatever, they can afford it. I don't get the logic of picking. And Rafael Devers is a really good player. This is not, you know, like whatever, all the necessary caveats. But he's not as good as Xander Bogaerts, and he's not as good as Mookie Betts, both in terms of his offense and his, well, maybe not in terms of his offense, but at least certainly in terms of his defensive utility. Why you're going to pay him the $330 over those two guys, I don't know if I totally understand that. But I guess they had to do it.
He's younger than those guys were, and then they had to do it. I think what you're looking at is a bit of a storm.
Well, that's true. No, it bought them 7 minutes of goodwill before Trevor Story got hurt. That's true. No, everyone in Boston is running around being like, oh my gosh, we re-signed Devers. That's not what a Boston accent. What is a Boston accent?
That was brutal.
No, hold on. Give me a second.
Whoa, we re-signed Devers, did we?
What is that?
When I try and do a Boston accent, the way I get into it is I think about the principal at Milton High who accosted me for looking through the yearbook about Rich Hill. He goes, you trying to get dirt on Richie?
I just go full Quimby. I'm happy they signed Devers.
Anyway, yeah, they had to do it, right? Because, oh, geez, you know, yeah. I mean, whatever, good for him. Good for Devers. He's a good player. He's 26. He'll, you know, maybe spend several more years at third base.
Why are we dismissing the fact that they had to do it? Because it feels like you are looking at that and think it's ridiculous when, I mean, those folks have been on fire all off season long. And, you know, if Chaim Bloom wants to continue running the team, you figure at some point he's going to have to do this.
Why do you think Chaim Bloom is in charge? Like,
well, okay, fine, right. Okay,
come on.
So at some point, you have to get the owners on board, and they're feeling the heat. Like, and we know that, like, that kind of thing actually happens in this sport. I mean, doesn't it? Like, people feel pressure. Owners feel pressure. And when the narrative is what it was all offseason long there, I mean, like, I don't know. I don't know if I would be as dismissive about them having to do it.
I mean, it just feels like compounding mistakes. Right?
You make the mistake. Every deal like that feel like compounding mistakes, though?
I mean, no. Like that. I don't feel like the Yankees signing Gerrit Cole was compounding a mistake. I feel like it was getting a great player at a record contract. Like, you make the mistake of trading Betts and losing the trade. Okay, you make the mistake of, for several months or, you know, a year, misreading the Bogaerts market. And now, okay, we'll fix it by taking a player who's not as good as the other two, who has, you know, accomplished less. Like, yes, he's younger, which also means he has a shorter track record, and extending him to this, you know, whatever. They can afford it. I don't know. This idea that they had to do it. Well, if they had to do it, they also had to keep Bogaerts, right? They also, like, you know, had to sign Betts a couple years ago. Like, you don't have to do anything. You can, but, like, I don't know. Anyway.
They had to sign.
I don't understand why all of a sudden, like, the pressure is real now.
Because the correct answer was to sign Betts, right? That is, you keep Betts, you keep Betts, you keep Betts. That's the real correct answer. And then after that, if you let Bogaerts go and then you sign Devers and you've locked up two of these guys and said, well, this one got away. Listen, you're going to get a little bit more goodwill with that, but when you trade Betts for Alex Verdugo and you've already released Jeter Downs or DFA'd him, and you get to a point where you're not just buying Rafael Devers, who, to me, I think you're minimizing how good he is. He's a 5-win player, a 140 OPS plus guy who's 25 or just turned 26. Like, he's a good player. But if you let that guy go, if you're the Red Sox and you let that guy go, you are the Pirates. You are just announcing to the world that Bob Nutting has bought your team. And I don't think you can have that. I just, it maybe can't is too strong a word. You certainly can, but it doesn't help the brand that the Red Sox have furnished all these years.
All right, Devers is pretty good. I just looked up his numbers. He's a good player.
He's a good player. No, I like him a lot. But yeah, I don't know. The Red Sox are fascinating to me. But you had a couple of good ideas. You're the glue of the show. Andy McCullough, glue of the show, you came up with a couple of ideas in our Slack, our pre-planning Slack. I was absent from the idea generation because these ideas were so good. Why would I contribute to these already fully formed ideas? Andy, which one do you want to start with first?
I got this in the question of a mailbag last week, and it was from Alex G. And it's, hi, Andy. What are the trends in baseball analysis or front office behavior that you think will look silly 10 years down the road? On the podcast, you often bring up Fire Joe Morgan style thinking. What, if anything, do you see now that might be similar? I have one sort of idea, but I'd be curious if anything immediately jumped to mind for you guys.
I'm at a loss because I generally don't think I know how front offices work these days. I think I've been left in the dust. Seriously, like I feel like they are looking from a manual that I haven't had access to. You know, they're not sharing it with me. So I'm still stuck a little bit in 2017, thinking like it's a post-Moneyball, but pre-whatever they're looking at. Boy, I don't know. My whole bugaboo was always, the layman using WAR for catchers is going to be just dumb as hell in like 20 years. Like when we're trying to compare like, well, Josh Donaldson's, you know, a 3-win player, but Yadier Molina is like a 2-win player. Dumb as hell. And we're going to look back and that's going to be a bad high school haircut soon, I think. I think it already is in a way, but that's my initial thought. But I don't know front offices well enough to know what they're, because I remember when the A's just gave up on defense a couple years ago when they were contending and that didn't work out. And then you see teams kind of pivot toward all defense, like the Guardians in a way. And that kind of doesn't work out. So I don't know. I don't, I'm kind of at a loss for this question.
I don't understand the question. Like, yeah, well, I just don't understand.
You haven't covered baseball in many bullshit. Years.
So like, what? Explain to me, like, what the hell are we asking here? Like, what?
Okay, so Mark, you remember the website Fire?
Yeah, right? Of course.
Okay. So the point that I had often made is that these sort of craven behaviors of the owners made it so that the type of thinking that would get you, if you'd written a column in 2008 advocating that type of thinking, would get you torched on Fire Joe
Morgan.
Okay,
all right. Okay.
So this idea of like, he's a good, you know, he's a good player. You should give him a 7-year contract, right? Because whereas like on Fire Joe Morgan, they would like pinpoint all of the like, well, here's why that deal might not work, blah, blah, blah. And the reason the shift happened is mostly just because the owners were, you know, like had fake austerity for several years in that kind of 2016 to 2018 period. And that led it so that when like Madison Bumgarner got a big contract or, you know, Dallas Keuchel got a multi-year deal, the reaction was like, great, you know, they gave him a big deal. Whereas, you know, front offices were like, well, here's why, you know, that might not be a great idea. But if you wrote that, you know, you'd be like anti-labor, if that makes sense. So just like stuff that you see that is sort of lauded now that maybe down the road will be like, why were we doing that?
Bootlicking about optionality. Huh? Like just a fancy ass name for we're not doing shit. Like, come on. Come on. Like, options, shut up, right? Like, you're choosing to not make your team better. That's what it is, you know? And like, okay, sure, okay, we'll make him better later, maybe, all right? But like, what if you don't? Then what have you done? He's been passive. It's ridiculous. And so like, does that fit your definition?
Are you talking about optionality or threading the needle?
Both. Are they the same?
Not really.
I mean, whatever. Like, they're all just like front office gobbledygook to me.
Well, that's fair.
You bringing up optionality just makes me think of options. And that actually gives me an answer for this question. The way the Giants operate is to just cycle through waiver claims and DFAs. And they're grabbing this guy because they have a spot in the 40-man roster. And then they're getting rid of him a week later because they have another shiny toy who came across the waiver wire. I think that sucks on a human level to yo-yo these guys around. And also the idea of we have these relievers and these players with options and we're going to build an 18-man bullpen by optioning up this guy and down and up and down. I think that sucks. And I want to say that that will have on-field effects, ramifications throughout the organization that we aren't quite in tune with yet. That's going to be my hot take because, I mean, pro-labor, right? That's a pro-labor take. And why aren't we thinking about the labor in this? And so that, I think, is my Fire Joe Morgan.
Wouldn't Fire Joe Morgan be like, that's a great take?
It's not,
this
we're
is
not.
Modern.
Well, this is what we're saying, you know, Mark. You need to clean it up.
What? I've been out of this for a couple weeks. Sorry. A
couple weeks?
Well, for anyway. A while. Yeah.
Can I make a revelation here? Like an on-podcast, drop a little
What you got? Revelation. What you got?
Back in the day, I started up an anonymous blog called Fire, Fire Joe Morgan.
And whoa.
In which I took to task the Fire Joe Morgan posts that bugged me the most. I think I did two before losing steam. I can't find it anymore. But I was not on the Fire Joe Morgan train. They bugged me back in the... And look, I love The Office. I love the right. works of Michael Schur. Like, don't get me wrong. Sure, dude's sure. a genius. But I had a little ghost blog for two posts.
Wow. What was it that upset you?
Just, I didn't like the format of taking this and then adding commentary and the next paragraph and commentary. It felt like a way to just end a debate. There was no possibility of a response. It was just boom, boom, boom. And it was so easy to be like, yeah, yeah. And then it lacked, like, you couldn't critically analyze the critical analysis.
Oh, so you just don't like the concept of fisking.
Fisking? What's fisking?
That's what the that's what that technique is called. It's called fisking.
Okay. Okay. After, yeah. Yeah. I don't like after fisking.
An intellectual named Robert Fisk, I believe, invented that technique. It's interesting to go back and read FJM at times. One, because it's still just very funny in a lot of different ways. Still, I mean, hard to believe guys who created a bunch of hit television shows were actually very funny. And it's also just interesting to see some of the ideas, some of the ways that they were dogmatic in a way that was as dogmatic as the, you know, stats versus scout bait back then. I also love reading the times they will go after my good friend and former colleague Bill Plaschke, who has a great sense of humor, two has really embraced like sort of newfangled thinking in a way that a lot of folks with his esteem and ability to turn a phrase maybe haven't. And sometimes one time I had to break the news to him that Fire Joe Morgan was the guys who like made The Office and Parks and Rec and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And he was like, what? Those are some of my favorite shows. How could they do that to me?
Yeah, that's so good.
Any excuse to get a Plaschke impersonation on here. I'm down for it.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Do you ever wish you could have something both ways? A zero-calorie cheeseburger, red wine with no headache, new baseball uniforms that aren't see-through. Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but you can have both with Mack Weldon's timeless apparel with performance fabrics. I just got Mack Weldon's silver crew neck tee in a couple of different colors in the Silver Peak Polo. They're awesome. They look fantastic, but more importantly, they're the most comfortable shirts I've ever worn, and that's important. They're nice enough that I wear them to work, but so comfortable that they're a go-to on the weekends too. It's not flashy, just classic, always in style clothing made with performance materials, but those materials don't give their clothing that techie, shiny look that you see a lot of the time. They also have shorts, sweats, and warmer weather fleeces and button-up shirts, all the things you need any season of the year. Don't take my word for it, though. Try it yourself. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com and the promo code MLB Show.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. You don't get that many opportunities to upgrade your organization through a terrific hire. LinkedIn Jobs helps you to nail those chances. We've all searched for a job at some point in our lives, and chances are, if you're like me, you've used LinkedIn as a resource to network and follow the trends in your industry. You've spent a lot of time on LinkedIn, so why wouldn't you make that the place to post your job? LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open open to a perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. LinkedIn knows that small businesses are wearing so many hats and might not have the time or resources to hire. LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make that process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/MLB show. That's linkedin.com/MLB show to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
You know, the point, Grant, you made about catcher war, it was sort of, I think we're already past the, like, caring about framing stuff, but, like, trying to quantify catchers is something that we've tried and failed to do for basically, like, 15 years at this point, and with no end in sight.
I was catcher-pilled in 2020 when the Giants used two minor league free agents when Buster Posey opted out. They were kind of like, it's not like they were caught by surprise too. So they didn't have a ton of great options. They went with a pair of untested minor league free agents as a quasi platoon behind home plate. And I really saw in my heart's heart how important catching could be. I'd been spoiled by watching Buster Posey all these years. And you just assume that catching is, well, you do this and you're a solid catcher. But not having a really good field general, a really good catcher, when you don't have that, all of a sudden you notice. It's like you see the magic eye painting and you're like, whoa, this stuff is important. This base that was given up is important. This one strike that wasn't, you know, handled is important. All of this stuff, crazy important on just how it affects the game minute to minute, because they have so much input into every game. I am catcher-pilled, so I appreciate a good Yadier Molina. Yadi for Hall of Fame.
I voted for him for the MVP once.
We don't care about framing anymore?
Not to
me. I don't. I never cared.
Oh.
I care.
Okay. I don't know. I'm just trying. It's hard to keep track of what's cool and what's not. I'm sorry.
I still care about framing.
I turn to you guys to tell me what we're supposed to care about these days. So
there was like a period where it was like, well, this guy's framing is worth 77 wins. You know, like there were extremes. And you're like, gosh.
Jose Molina is actually like the most valuable player in baseball. It's like, maybe your system's off.
Yes. So I think we've dialed back from that. I think framing is still important, but the poles have narrowed.
Okay, all right. I just didn't know. I just want to be cool. Ignore the stuff that, you know, I'm supposed to ignore and care about the stuff I'm supposed to care about.
None of us are cool. All of our times have, like, really passed.
So passed. Man. Do you remember what it was like to just, your team that you're covering would make a move and you would go look up that player's on-base percentage and just be like, well, that move stunk. And that's it. That's the analysis. That is, I missed that. I was such a smart man. And now look at me. I'm old and withered.
Yeah, it used to be like you would look up and be like, well, this guy doesn't get on base. This is a terrible signing. And now you find people like being like, well, he hit the ball very hard last year. And it's like, what? Like, he had a 200 on base percentage. Like, yeah, but if you look at his, you know, barrel rate, it's like, what?
The spin rate of his barrels, man. The spin rate of his barrels are just going to blow your freaking mind.
This is my favorite one. You know, ERA was +5 and, you know, walked everyone in the ballpark. But that slider's got some very interesting characteristics.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can dream on that slider.
I think that's the thing that will be corrected back in the coming years is, like, stuff will – people will stop – like disregarding results and paying for stuff.
I don't know, because you saw it when the Padres traded for Joe Musgrove. They were trading for a guy with a 4 ERA, a consistently ho-hum starting pitcher. And they're like, no. You don't know Joe Musgrove. They were right. And when the Giants signed Kevin Gausman to a contract and he's got an ERA of 5-6 with the Braves that gets him put on waivers, and they're like, no, we got this. We're just going to have him throw a split finger more. And they're right. And so
until that sort of banana stuff stops working. I just trust, look, the Dodgers are like, yeah, no, we'll fix Andrew Heaney. They're right. And Tyler Anderson, yeah, he's got a great changeup. And they're right.
But what's going to happen is that as the becomes more homogenous of like all the teams understand now, like, hey, you got two really good pitches. What if you threw them 90% of the time rather than you got to have a 65% fastball or whatever? And so as that becomes more homogenous, the value, like, there's just going to be fewer exploits available. You know, the Astros were doing that several years ago where they're like, oh, we'll get, you know, Garrett Cole and we'll get him to stop, you know, throwing two seamers. Like, we'll get Ryan Presley and, you know, we'll change this with Justin Verlander, et cetera, et cetera. That's just going to become less prevalent because more teams now, like, can all look at the pitch data and just be like, okay, that guy's got a really good slider.
What's a good indication of when that's passed? When the Rockies start doing it? Like, if Colorado pulls that off, you're just like, oh man, everyone knows it now. Secret's out, fellas.
That's like a philosophical theorem, like the, you know, right? The Rockies line.
Yeah, the jig is up.
Yeah, the Phillies getting an analytics department several years ago was a real, you know, line in the sand that just changed the sport. It's like, okay, everyone's on board now.
That is a good point, because what you're going to have is the front office types from these teams, the assistant's going to become above the assistant. The assistant to the assistant's going to become an assistant GM somewhere. The brain tree is going to spread out and infiltrate teams, not the Rockies, because they can't afford anyone. But just the other 29 teams will get these guys from the Astros, from the Dodgers, and it'll just spread like that, and that will dilute it. That's a good point.
Look at what the Royals have done, you know, this offseason, you know, where it's like, hey, we're a small market team that really needs to be, thank you, there's the bell. We're a small market team that really needs to be based around pitching. We have a lot of pitching talent. We're not, you know, maybe squeezing as much out of it as we can. Hey, let's start hiring some people from the Guardians and the Rays. So it becomes a more homogenous sport in some ways.
I wonder though, like, I mean, okay, you're right about that, because the information that gets used becomes so much more widespread. But the thing that, when you talk to folks about this, one thing they insist upon is that execution still matters, right? And like, isn't that sort of where the different, like, even if you're using the same data sets and like a lot of the science behind this is the same, we know there are some organizations who are better communicating this stuff than others. There are some places where you can have that conversation and it gets to the people it needs to get to in a form that they can take action on. And there are other places, and we see this too, that, you know, they make a big deal, oh, we're in, we're all doing all this stuff, but they still can't get it in a usable form to their players, or there's something in the chain that breaks down. So I kind of wonder how long that process sort of takes to where everyone can do this effectively. There's another human part of it too, and this is just sort of the folks you're dealing with, but like, there's an ego part of this. There's an ego part of being the front office that can pull this off, that can take Tyler Anderson and turn him into this. And I think so long as there's an element of you're going to get some points for doing that, right? Grant, I think, like, I don't know. I think the answer's somewhere in the middle. It's going to catch up where, you know, everyone's doing it eventually. I think the window gets extended a little bit because you have the execution aspect of it that, like, you can't standardize, even if the data is all the same. And the second part of it is just that raw ego part where it's like, you know, organizations are going to think, hey, we've got the answers. We're going to take these risks. We're going to, and you know damn well that happens with these guys. And like, I don't think that's a bad thing, actually. I think like it's great, but like, I think that's going to extend this window out that Grant is talking about where this is still a thing for a while.
I think that what you're talking about, I really do think the Giants are high on their own estimation of how they can improve pitchers. And they should be. They should be. They have a recent track record, but they're like, oh, you can pay Carlos Rodon that much money. Or you could pay Ross Stripling and Sean Manaea a third of that, get two pitchers, and be in your owner's good graces because you've spent a lot less money for a lot less risk and a lot shorter time. So I don't know. I do see that as being a challenge for them.
But that's also an old concept of like, if, hey, you've got something that's worth a dollar, well, what if I give you two things that are worth 60 cents, which is worth more? I mean, that's like as old as time. And they might also be right about that, by the way, because there is less risk in signing Ross Stripling and Sean Manaea for a combined, what, 2 years and $45 million than there is in signing Rodon for, you know, $7,150 or $6,150. So, like, yeah.
I do it too. Like, I go to the record store and I will go and I will go through the bargain bins and I'll end up with $30 worth of records. And it's like, check this out. I've got the soundtrack to American Gigolo. And I've got like this Herb Alpert record that's kind of silly cover. Look at this. And then someone says, well, couldn't you have bought like a $30 reissue of a Miles Davis? Like, you know, you'll like that. He's really good. He's literally Miles Davis. And they're right. But I have 30 albums. Some of them are silly. And that's better for me.
Your response should be, think of the optionality.
I mean, come on. I have a soundtrack for the seventh voyage of Sinbad right here. Just buy my podcast department and you don't. Like, so I win. Yeah, you're stunned. You're stunned.
Is that Sinbad the comic?
No, it's an original Bernard Herrmann score. It's a very important in soundtracks.
I wonder when it became a Sinbad. Anyway.
He was
sick. The Genie movie. He got killed in the Genie movie. Remember that?
Yeah, that's the Mandela effect, right?
Yeah.
Right. Right. Hey, we were going to have a guest on the pod today, by the way. We invited John Angelos to be here today. Unfortunately, January 17th, when we're recording Tuesday, is Benjamin Franklin Day. I'm not making that up. And he thought it would be inappropriate at a time when there is not enough electricity around the world to discuss baseball matters on this day. So maybe next week.
That's fair.
Here. How brutal is that, man? How brutal is that? I mean, so, Dan Connolly wrote a great column about it, about brutal to watch. Oh, my goodness.
I couldn't get through it. I literally couldn't get through it.
The good news is, once he's done opening the books for the Oriole beat writers, maybe he'll have time to come onto our pod.
Yes,
he's all about transparency. So, you know, once he's done showing him the books, maybe we're next, man. So don't give up on him, is what I'm saying. Cut him some slack.
I'm starting, call me if I'm talking out of school here. Like, call me out if I'm talking out of school here. But I'm starting to think that sometimes the people who are in power and have the money aren't always necessarily there because of merit. Right? Sometimes it's who your dad is. Sometimes it's a theory. I'm formulating it. Like, maybe he's not there because he's the best person to run the Orioles, but I don't want to talk out of school.
I really, really, really try hard not to fall into that thing where you just label somebody the very easy cheap shot, right? And the born on third base is a classic one. Classic. And, you know, certainly not everybody who was born on third base is that, right? Like, I think certainly that you can't, that's not fair. However, man, that's hard to do when somebody shows their ass like that and shows that, yes, I was born on third base and here is a silver spoon that I shoved in my mouth. Here you go. And that's what happened yesterday. If you haven't seen the exchange, it is cringy. God, is it cringy. And this is John Angelos versus our Dan Connolly, who, by the way,
I mean, it's not even versus.
Right, right.
Dan held his own.
He did.
Comported himself perfectly professionally. Like, but he's not like being antagonistic in that. Like, he's asking a question to the owner that's pretty vital to, you know, like the future of the franchise.
Yes. He asked a question in a press availability. Okay. And the owner freaks out. So, like, you know, again, you want to, I want to give people the benefit of the doubt, but then when they make it impossible, like John Angelos did yesterday, that's brutal. He's everything that you associate with that label. At least that's what that interaction looked like. And the thing is, you know, this is with people in the room and cameras on. You know, the thing that's also true about baseball is that these are all just small little companies, right? Really, like, a lot of them are just like, you know, where you feel it when the people running them behave this way. It creates a toxic environment. It creates an environment where you can't get things done, where there's turf wars, there's no communications. All anyone who's worked at a place like that, you guys are feeling it right now. Well, that happens in baseball. You got 30 of them, and some of them are good, and some of them are this. So when I'm watching that yesterday, it's not just that, wow, he's kind of being an idiot in front of all these people. But imagine what that is in closed doors with people that work for him. Imagine that act for a second. And then you look at the Baltimore Orioles and you're like, man, they've haven't been good in quite some time. You start to figure out why. Okay, maybe it is because the owner creates an environment like this. Because if that's what you're doing in front of the cameras, then good Lord, imagine what's happening behind closed doors every day.
I think the number one rule in baseball, anything, any discipline, any study, any science, is that you don't know it all. You will never know it all. Every system is too complicated. How many, we have what, 75 combined years of covering baseball experience on this podcast, and we're morons. We would run a team into the ground, and we've done nothing but think about baseball for decades. Just, and all that experience has taught us that we don't necessarily know anything. Some people lack that. That's the Dunning-Kruger, whatever you want to call it, but it's just, it's so on display sometimes that it hurts. And some people just think like, yeah, you know, I can do it all. I can, oh gosh, I'm trying to think of a weird hypothetical scenario. I can buy a social media network, and because I do rocket ships and fancy electric cars, and I can run that beautifully because I'm a freaking genius. And you just see it. You're not always in control of everything.
It's not limited to Baltimore, obviously, right? It manifests in different ways. It manifests in very often when owners talk publicly. You know, it's John Angelos's behavior the other day. It's Phil Castellini, you know, sort of like almost openly antagonizing Reds fans and saying, you know, where are you going to go? And then the other day he said like they're a nonprofit or something. It's, you know, the Dodgers ownership just declining to address Trevor Bauer. They're just never going to talk about Trevor Bauer. The decision they made to release him, it's a sort of class-wide disdain for like the press, the customer, whoever, but people who they do not feel are privileged enough to be involved in these situations. And it's, you know, fans lose out, and it's not an appealing look for the sport. You want to talk about the optics of the sport. It's not great, you know, to see this, but who's going to police them? That's, you know, maybe a bigger question, right? Like, they run the sport.
I want to push back on it. Not even push back. I'm just curious. Like, you talk about the optics of this, how it looks bad. Like, does it? Because, like, literally every time there's a confrontation between ownership and players, it feels like even in this day and age, public lines up for the owner's side. It's about the laundry. It's about the team. And I say this in the, okay, here's another thing. Professional politician types make a huge deal out of debates. Oh man, you got to win the debate. You can't look like an idiot, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, I don't know. You have people stepping in holes in debates all the time. Doesn't seem to matter come election day. So I kind of wonder, like, have people become either desensitized to it, or it's just sort of like the way we handle things in general, where something's a big deal for like 2 minutes and then it just disappears into the ether. And because these folks don't talk very often, they can kind of go in there, step in the hole, say their stupid thing. You know, baseball owners say stupid things week. It gets done, and then we don't do it again for another 4 years. Because, like, you know, some of this stuff is just, like, terrible. But, like, there never seems to be any actual follow-up with it. Like, fans don't really, like, stay.
Are you suggesting that billionaires might have a little too much power and control in American society?
You know,
come now. Look, it's hard for me to relate to like the ownership class of sports teams. The only thing we really have in common is like I'm white and I'm pretty sure my grandfather cheated on his taxes. You know, so like other than that, right? Very different lived experiences. So you try and give the benefit of the doubt, but like tough, man, tough hang.
When owners step in it and they become the story of the week, the month, the year, whatever, that's all kind of cured by winning, right? And it's also cured by them shutting up. Because I just realized as you were saying this, I haven't thought the name Jed York in a long time as a Niners fan. You know what I mean? Wow. I used to think about the name Jed York a lot because he'd make a stupid comment or the Niners are doing this and this is stupid and this. Boy, I sure have forgotten about that guy. And I'm pretty sure he wields still some power behind the scenes. But the Niners are winning. They're looking good. They're making the right moves. All of a sudden, yeah, so.
He stopped hiring the Jim Tomsulas of the world. That helped.
I will say this. Like, you know, winning does change things. And with the caveats of the Rays and the A's, who you know, the A's obviously are tanking now, but for quite some time, both teams have been very competitive or were very competitive, and it didn't really lead to a major change in attendance. But, like, you look at the bottom third of Major League attendance this past year, you'll see Pittsburgh there. You'll see Cincinnati there. You'll see the Orioles there. So it does have some effect. Now, maybe that will change with, you know, if the team wins, but, like, well, it's going to be an interesting test case for Baltimore this year because they should be competitive, right? They won 83 last year. We'll see if it, you know, leads to a change, like, at the, you know, ticket sales. I don't know.
Yeah. They will be one of my MLB TV teams, like, all year. Like, I love what the Orioles are putting down. So we shall see if all of a sudden we're like, which Angelos is it? Dale Angelos? Who is it?
Andy, how many times have you been on the receiving end of what Conley had yesterday?
From an owner? I don't know.
No, from anybody. From any, like, same similar setting. Like, it's because, like, see, the thing that's tough there with Dan, like, he doesn't want to be part of the story.
No.
Right? Like, he doesn't, no one wants to be part of the story, but, like, he's also got to ask the question. He's also got to sit there and wear it. So, like, it's unavoidable. He's part of the story. It sucks, which I thought, again, he handled it really well, but, like, I'm curious, do you remember ever being ensnared in something like that?
Yeah, I've had a couple, but never with the owner on TV and never with a person who you just don't see all that often. You know, I've had ones with the GM where it's like, we're not talking about that today. And then, you know, you go into the hallway and yell at each other for a while and figure it out, right? Like, or with the, you know, the manager or a player, you know, the thing is with the owners, they are so removed from this. They don't talk to the public, so they don't have relationships with the people who cover the team. So, you know, and they don't want them, clearly. They have no interest.
That's actually changed in the last 10 years. When I think about, like, who's owned clubs in the past, like, it wasn't that unusual to talk to those guys. I mean, it wasn't insane like it would be now. Like, I actually think it's changed a bit.
The Phillies clubhouse, and this, again, this is a very unique circumstance in that the Phillies are literally in the World Series and they just won a game. But, like, John Middleton was just kind of hanging out in the room. And, you know, he finished an interview with someone and I just went up to him and talked to him for, you know, like 10 minutes. He was, you know, it was really interesting to hear his perspective or whatever. And I was just thinking, like, when was the last time I saw this? Like, you know, I don't remember that with, like, Mark Walter at a Dodgers game or something like that. Now, like, look, it's not, it doesn't make John Middleton citizen of the year, right? To, like, be there to kind of be like, hey, the team I own just won. But, like, at the very least, like, puts a touch of personableness, if that's a word. And there is theoretically the chance to, you know, like, have some better connection with the public if you actually interact with the press. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The Giants have an ownership group, and they have a public face of that group, and that's Larry Bear. And that's kind of their strategy. And then when you kind of peel back the layers, it's like, oh, actually the majority ownership stake is Charles Johnson, who is just giving all the Giants profits to Herschel Walker, which maybe isn't great. But yeah, like, you have that public facing Larry Bear, and that's been their strategy, to have someone who's personal, because it does make a difference. It's like, this is the guy kind of pulling the strings of the guy who pulls the strings, and that's important. All right, well, I just killed the discussion. So this has been episode 37 of the Roundtable. We will be back at some point to talk about Carlos Correa's deal with the White Sox. Is it good for them? Is it not? We will tell you then. See you then.
Rakuten Golden Eagles.
No, dude, the Braves are going to extend them to a team-friendly deal. Like, come on.